LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guests today are Thomas Sheridan and Neil MacDonald, who join us to discuss their latest book, Bellinger Saunière, Priest Wizard of Rennes-le-Château. Rennes-le-Château in southern France has been a hotbed of conspiracy connections for centuries. Interest in its mysteries surged again in recent decades with the release of the popular and controversial books The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and The Da Vinci Code. But what if theories about its connections to Jesus, Mary Magdalene, the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, the Knights Templar and the Cathars are little more than a distraction or even willful misdirection? In their book, Thomas and Neil document their travels in the region and the discovery of a deeper, darker dimension to this fascinating place of power. Hello and welcome, Thomas, Neil. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks for inviting us. Brilliant.
Today we're discussing your new project, currently a book. There's also going to be a documentary. The title is Bellinger Saunière, Priest Wizard of Rennes-le-Château. Now, before we dive into all of that, give listeners a brief introduction. They shouldn't really need one if they're listeners to the show, but nonetheless, just for newbies.
Right, okay. So we've all probably heard about the Rennes-le-Château mystery anyway, because it really came to light with Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, which was, I think it was 1980, was it, something like that, and with Henry Lincoln on the he had a couple of television programs about it. But I've been going up there for 20 years now, and the main mystery is that this priest guy arrived at Rennes-le-Château to find a derelict old church, and he started mending it, got himself in trouble with the bishop, sent off to Narbonne and then to do teaching duties because he was a royalist, and that was the time of the revolution, and then he got sent back with a royal he was connected to royalty, and his family was connected, so he was sent back. They arranged for him to be sent back to Rennes-le-Château, and he found some documents, and then he became a massively wealthy, sort of multi-millionaire from nowhere. And so what Thomas and I were telling to do was go right back to the nitty-gritty of the story and say, well, okay, that was the mystery, where did he get his money from? And that is really what the book's all about.
The story first came across my radar back in the 90s when Holy Blood, Holy Grail came out. I was living and working in New York at the time. And I read the book on the subway in like 3 days. I really was fascinated by it. It was a great read, and put it away since then. You know, I didn't believe or disbelieve the stories behind it, but I found the actual book fascinating. It covered an enormous range of topics and subjects to do basically with France from the sort of like the late Middle Ages, from the time of the Holy Land through the Middle Ages of France and on into the Second World War. And yeah, I thought it was very fascinating, very interesting. Didn't really have the knowledge to doubt or study the claims made in it at the time. And I just took it as a very interesting non-fiction read. And that was that. Now, years later, I saw the original documentary that was done for the BBC with Henry Lincoln. It's a version on YouTube, and I must have seen it about 7 or 8 years ago, probably before I even met Neil. And I was like watching it, and there was one scene where they were showing how the painting by Poussin, the Behringers of Arcadia, the Shepherds of Arcadia, had this sacred geometry encoded into it, which I did remember in a book. And I was thinking to myself, that makes no sense. That's just throwing a shape on top of a paint, literally on top of a painting. And you're supposed to believe it's all very credible because of the fact it's a BBC documentary. The BBC wouldn't spend money, that kind of money, on woo-woo. And as the years went by, and then I got to know Neil, and we wouldn't even talk much about it, just have casual chats. And I would say things like, I don't know how the story is glued. How is the story glued together? I don't understand how you get from this parish priest to Mary Magdalene and all this. How is it all glued together? And Neil said, well, it's just huge gaps in it that don't make any sense. And that's the dialogue between us came from that.
Yeah, I picked up the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail like yourself in the 80s. I think it was 82. It came out. It would have been, I think, 85 by the time I got a dog-eared copy from a secondhand bookshop. And I read it cover to cover, found it fascinating. But like yourself, there was a lot in there that was new to me. But I felt there was something significant here. But it did, as you say, span so much territory. It was really like 2,000 years of history, wasn't it, in a way, from the time of Christ. Through all these historical periods, some of them hidden in, shrouded in mists that we know very little about, others, better documented. I kind of put the book back on the shelf and that was the end of it. But then later, I mean, in the 1950s is when articles about this guy, Saunier, and the goings on at Rennes le Château started to appear. But I think The Holy Blood, The Holy Grail was the first big, certainly in English anyway, bestseller on the subject. But then more and more started to appear, some of it not directly connected with Rennes le Château, but tangentially, as you say, bringing all these different strands together, or trying to, things which they were trying to make fit that didn't seem to. It was like having lots and lots of pieces from different jigsaws and trying to make one piece from it. And then, of course, later, there wasn't a subject really that stayed in the forefront of her mind. When the Da Vinci Code exploded, the book and then the movie, and suddenly everyone was talking about this. I revisited the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and really felt none the wiser. But I always felt that there is in all of this a mystery, an enigma somewhere in this man's life and goings on and those he was associated with, what this represents. But it's just so far not been crystallized. There's been a lot of misrepresentation, and I think some of it actually misdirection, some of it deliberate, and this is stuff that you do get into in the book.
Yeah, I would say the misdirection is like the main thing that we encountered. I mean, I remember Lionel Fanthorpe. Do you remember Lionel Fanthorpe? He was the reverend with the three-wheeler motorcycle, and he used to do a television program. He did a talk at the Mysterious Earth Conference a good few years ago, and he quoted then. He said it's like the mystery is like peeling an onion from the inside. I know that was the best way to explain it, because it goes off in so many different directions that your head spins, and then another whatever direction you go splits up and splits up. So it's as if everything points away from Saunier. I remember the first time I met Henry Lincoln. He said, "So are you up to date then?" And I said, "Well, I don't know what you mean." He said, "Well, Bornholm. Do you know about Bornholm?" And I don't know if you guys remember that, but what he was doing all these different lines in different directions. And Bornholm was it's an island in Denmark. So I'm there to ask about or to talk about Rennes le Château, and it's, yeah, but have you looked 1,000 miles to the north of that? And everything that was done throughout is always, don't look at the Seigneur himself. Look elsewhere. That's what we've said throughout, is that the question is, where did Saunier get his money from? And the answer isn't, Mary Magdalene got married to Jesus 1,000 years earlier. That's 1,500 years earlier, whatever. That doesn't answer the question, yet that is what everybody looks at.
There's no line you can draw between that money and its after effects and the story of the Magdalene bloodline. You read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and you're exposed to, now that you read it these days, a classic, what Carl Sagan referred to as a bamboozlement, where everything is thrown at you above the kitchen sink, and you're just kept going by the attention to what the book focused that one period. I can remember it was the first time I'd ever really heard a good account of the genocide of the Cathars, the Albanesian Crusade. And I remember being very emotional reading that second part of the book because I never realized this horrific slaughter had taken place. And then I went down and got Sean Martin's book, The Greatest Heresy. And there was other sections like they in the second book that followed up the one that mentions the place in Denmark. They talk about the Templar fleet escaping to Ireland and then to Scotland and sending Sinclairs and I'm like, no, what's this got to do with the initial story where and also I'll tell you, I immediately started to notice think of a Masonic ruse, the classic Masonic ruse, the a nod is a wink is a nod is as good as a wink to a blind man, and this kind of thing. And it just seemed to be that by the time Neil and I sat down and spoke about it, he'd kind of come to it separately, and I was kind of like wondering about it. That the whole thing, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail thing, was a colossal bamboozlement that gave you lots of juicy meat, but no bone, no sustenance. And the thing was that it just led you to places that were very interesting, very exciting, kind of fun, alternative history. But hold on a second, let's get back to this priest, this amazing parish priest. Now, like yourself, Greg, I instinctually knew there was something going on with that Poussin painting, and particularly that area that where the monument is located, that myself and Neil went to. And I knew there was something funny. I knew there was we could there was a paper trail that you could show that Saunier had all this money, but that was it. I'm convinced now. Well, I was convinced before we did this, but I was convinced for not convinced, but I wondered for a long time until Neil and I put our head together that there was a whole other story behind this, and it most certainly wasn't. Now, the Magdalene bloodline thing—that's irrelevant. That could be true. I personally don't believe it, but that's okay. It could still be true in a different way. But no way does that dovetail into any of the things to do with Ren Le Chateau Mysteries. You might as well be connecting Ren Le Chateau to ancient aliens with the amount of proof that's actually given.
Yeah, so what we decided to do then was instead of peel the onion from the inside, let's just chop it straight down the middle and say, oh, just stay away from all the misdirections and just concentrate directly with the Saunier mystery itself, and that's really. And I think this is the first time anybody has put this down in a book. I don't think anybody's came to the same conclusions as we have.
Yeah, it's classic conspiracy theory. You put air quotes around that, obviously, because conspiracies do exist. But then there's also the realm of like just as you say, misdirection and paper trails and things that, misdirection, things that lead you down blind alleys. And with this being wrapped up in stuff that's as vivid as the Holy Blood and Holy Grail material is kind of. Captures the imagination. Then you look at something like the Da Vinci Code. It's almost like once it becomes part of that world, that it can never escape. The gravitational pull of that. In the, I mean, you can even find material connecting. You mentioned ancient aliens, Thomas, connecting the UFO phenomena with Ren Le Chateau. And as soon as, I mean, some of it is going to be like deliberate and not just misdirection, but that contamination of genuine theories by association. You see this with, stories around 9/11. We saw it with the pandemic. So that anybody that's questioning, oh, well, actually, what is this? And what's the story here? And what's the motivation here? And why, the who, when, why, where, and how that detectives follow is all invalidated because somebody's has gone, oh, UFOs, or in this case, Mary Magdalene, Bride of Christ. Yeah, that becomes almost impossible to extricate yourself from that. So I understand, Neil, your point about cutting the onion down the middle is very valid. You're just trying to cut to the chase and look at the heart of the matter and get back to basics as if all this stuff never happened. Because in some ways, when I read your book and kind of revisited some of that material that I'd read about before, I was reminded of, like, this is a, if you look at his Saunier's actual situation, his background, how he arrived at Rennes-le-Château. He renovates the place, and where did this money come from? But look at who he's connected with. Look at the people that he entertains there, guests, etc. And then a whole different narrative begins to emerge that really has got, as you say, nothing to do with all these other, equally interesting narratives.
Yeah, I mean, it's as if everything's been just, it was so overshadowed by the Magdalene element of it. And everybody wanted it to be as well, because it sort of fitted in politically, which was very clever. But the story of what actually Sonia did at Rennes-le-Château is fascinating, if you can just concentrate on that. I mean, it's a dream world, really. It was quite a pleasure. But I remember the first time I entered into the church of Rennes-le-Château. I said, this is like a Rosicrucian temple. It's not like a church. And then I almost immediately forgot that. I mention it every time I go, but then I forgot it because I was misdirected in the same way as everybody else was.
There are thousands of churches across Europe called the Church of Mary Magdalene, or the Church of the Holy Magdalene, or the Mary Magdalene Church kind of thing. There's many, many of them. In England, even, there's lots of them. But that was the only thing that glued that location, that parish, to the Magdalene bloodline story was literally its name. There was nothing else. There was nothing else, nothing substantial, nothing evidential, nothing that you could actually say led the Jesus bloodline story at that point. And as Neil said, it was politically very correct because if you're looking for the wife of Jesus, what does that really tell you more than anything else? That Jesus existed. So the Christian churches were absolutely delighted, both the Catholics and the Protestants, with the whole Holy Blood, Holy Grail thing, because even if there was a kind of an element of blasphemy that he wasn't, that he was married and had kids, in that sense, we should say a silent heresy, a graceful heresy, it still validated the fact that this character existed. And it also tied in beautifully to the idea that if he did have children with Mary Magdalene, then that kind of validated the rule of the ascendancy class, like the royalty of Europe and so on. And then, when you start thinking about it that way, it gets very, very suspicious, especially when you have a scenario where the same publisher published Holy Blood, Holy Blood, Grail and the Da Vinci Code started a legal action against itself in order to ensure that both books would sell and drive the narrative further and deeper home. And then you have the bamboozle. Now, I was, before I got really deep into it, Neil, I was ready to kind of say, oh, that's it. It's a load of nonsense. It's made up. But it was when I read Neil's book on the Cathar country and looked at the photographs and stuff, and in particular, okay, it's like Neil says, it looks like a Rosicrucian church, right? Well, you walk in the door, right? And to your right is the altar. It's quite a small church, but it doesn't, like Neil said, it doesn't feel like a church. It does have a lot in common with the Preceptories of the Knights Templar, I'll give it that, but it's not really though. But on your left is a statue of a devil, and that changes everything.
And as you're walking in as well, looking at you,
And I say devil in quotations, by the way, because that's not what it is.
Is that the one that's on the font that has been vandalized?
Yeah, that's a statue on the way in that was. It said it's somebody's been in and smashed its head, which is three times now. In fact, they've actually put it into a Perspex container, which is such a shame because it ruins the visual aspects of it. But that's another reason. Well, why are people, going in there? Why is it that important to some people that they have to do this to it? Well, the church itself was actually the family chapel of the Hatchpool-Blanchefort family that were the lords of Rennes-le-Château. They lived in the chateau next door. So it was actually, it was their own church. It wasn't like the church for the village. Even though and that's why the secrets, the Hatchpool-Blanchefort secrets got hid there. But I was thinking, I went last week and I walked in and something occurred to me that had never occurred before, that Sonia seemed to have taste. These gardens were beautiful that he laid out, these tower and the bookcases. He had a beautiful eye for the aesthetic. It was, but the statues in there of the saints are huge. They don't seem to fit in there at all. And I was thinking of what you said, Thomas, about being burlesqued. And it was almost as if these statues were burlesquing the saints and the church itself.
I read something about, I don't know if how much of bear in mind there's been a church on that site for at least 1,000 years. It just fell into ruin and it was various times and restored, and what is one of the major restorations that Sonnier undertook. But that some of the statues and things were from a catalogue. They weren't made specially for the church, but they were ordered from a catalogue by a sculptor somewhere maybe in Paris, I can't remember quite, but who offered these for church restorations so that you could go on and say, right, which saints do we want for the restoration? And you could just like, yeah, I'll have number 42 and number 51, please, that type of thing. So
Yeah, but he could have picked someone that fit into the church in some way because I mean they're just huge. When you go in, they are too big for the size of that really small church. If you were planning a church yourself, you would find some smaller ones, put it that way.
oh yeah, I mean, and even if they were made by somebody else to a pattern or whatever, like made a number of these for different places, as you said, it doesn't mean that they'd be from different sized buildings and they just look outsized in that building. It's definitely, I'd say, even if it was unintentional, it kind of seems to send a message, doesn't it? As you say, it has an effect upon the visitor, shall we say, regardless of what the motivation might have been.
Absolutely. And Sonia was not the type of man to do something by mistake. I mean, everything he did was planned and double planned. His whole life was. I mean, I could go into, because he used to go out and avoid the bishop, and he would have certain letters for Mary, his housekeeper, to give. And I mean, everything he did was planned. He wouldn't make a mistake.
So the mainstream portrayal of him, sorry to cut across you, Thomas, seems to have been like a corrupt priest who enriched himself by selling indulgences, had these follies and little projects, and then basically was shoved out of the church in disgrace. That's the impression that the mainstream reader is left with.
They say that. I mean, that's an excuse, isn't it? It's like saying, it's like the guys who made the crop circles, they did it with a stick. That's all. Don't worry about it. I mean, how did he make so much money? Oh, he sold some indulgences. Well, he would have had to. I think it was worked out by somebody. He would have to do that for about 1,000 years to make any input of the amount of money he got. It was just another diversion, really.
If you look at the socio-economic factors of the region, that part of France, Spain, Pyrenees border was one of the most poorest areas in Europe. And for centuries and centuries, especially in his time, the economy was just pretty bad. There's no way he could have sold plenary indulgences to raise the kind of money he did within that, wrecked economy, that poor, mostly, sustenance farming economy and things like wineries, and there just wasn't that kind of money there. And you were talking about the manufacturers. They're called Giscard. They're in Toulouse, and they're a statuary manufacturing company. And one of the best smoking, guns we have is the receipts still exist from his order from the statuary place. And the Giscard factory were a church outfitters. So they did not only the statues and gargoyles and interior churches buildings, but they also did things like the pews and the all those kinds of fittings you get inside a Catholic church. And the receipt says he ordered a devil, and it just says a devil. And it wasn't in the regular. Now, it was, like you said, Greg, it was a catalog. You could order like number two and number six because they had like it would have been a printed catalog with images of like the different crucifixes and stuff. But he commissioned specially a devil. That is the smoking gun. That is when we have the first clue of what this story is really about.
Well, I was reminded when I looked, I really studied images of the church for the first time in detail while reading your book. The first thought I had was like, was Rosslyn Chapel in terms of something that's speaking to you in a coded language. If you mean something that has significance that, yes, is mired in to some extent or certainly wrapped up in these other people's ideas about what's going on, but there's still something significant there. Sometimes you can view a place or you can experience a sequence of events or whatever it happens to be, and you understand that there's something here. I'm echoing what I said earlier on, but you may or may not be able to divine what that is, but you know that there it's of significance. In the same way, I mentioned earlier about situations in the modern era, like 9/11, like the pandemic. I come back to these again and again, but I think a lot of us knew there was something, there was a subtext here that was what the profundity was, that the real story was beneath the surface of the events. And I felt when I looked, even just at the building itself and what he did with it, there's something here that deliberately or otherwise tells us a story or holds clues to what lies behind all of this.
Yeah, definitely. And not only the church, but all the gardens and his whole domain is lends secrets. But it is definitely that statue as you walk in, that when you start looking at it and in detail and thinking it out, it just tells the whole story in itself. That's in the old pentagram thing. It's leaves it's the it's the morning star, isn't it? So that's the light bringer, which is Lucifer, and the whole th I mean all they ever did was talk of, well, a lot of translations of the story have been centered around the pentagram, and the pentagram they could lead it straight back to the same, well, back also back to Solomon's Temple as well, with
Yeah.
what we'll get into.
Well, when myself and Neil were there, I saw the church and I says, okay, that's very cool. That's very interesting statue of the quote unquote devil. But what really did it for me was you do not connect a formal gardens with a church. It doesn't exist in the Christian world. And the minute I walked out the back door through his house and into this formal gardens, I knew what this place really was. It's a pagan temple. This is a classic pagan temple, like you would have found the ruins of the temple of Lupiter in Pompeii or all over the classical world, where you would have had the temple to venerate or petition the gods, and adjacent to it, a formal garden. For a pleasure garden for the gods to come and enjoy, whether they be flora or pan or anything like this. Sometimes they would have a wooded area. I knew immediately I was inside a pagan temple. There was no doubt to me. As soon as I walked into that formal garden, what they call the orangery, I knew I was in a pagan temple. It was laid out like a pagan temple. It was adjacent to what would have been called a temple in pagan times. And then that was the moment everything clicked together. We went back to the hotel that evening, and I said, I know what this is. I know what this is." And it was like the old gods are working through me. And I came up to Neil and I said, "Neil, I know what this place is. It's not a crap Catholic church. It's nothing to do with Mary Magdalene. It's a pagan temple, but also a kind of a homage to the original temple in Jerusalem built by Solomon, hence the pentagrams."
Yeah, I remember. I was sat there waiting when we got in for dinner, weren't we? And we'd already decided that we kind of decided we knew what it was, kind of, but we didn't. The story wasn't complete. And when you came down for dinner and said, "I've got it. I know what it's going on there," because you'd read the grimoire, hadn't you, for
Yeah,
the letters to get what
the
is.
Lesser Key of Solomon,
Yeah, that's key.
and also the pseudographical and the pseudo historical grimoires talk about what that demon is, and it's Asmodeus. Asmodeus is petitioned with opulent banquets, and Neil found the receipts for the kind of meals that they would put on in
Oh,
those
wow,
formal gardens, these opulent banquets. Saunier had basically become a kind of a pagan priest and had found the correct documents to do it under the church that had been buried there, maybe possibly from the actual original Hebrew documents from the Temple of Solomon. There's
yeah.
also a link which I will tell Neil about. Neil explained back to a place called Alay Laban, which is basically the where this happened to us, and it's also the headquarters of Kabbalah. But basically, Saunier wasn't there for the Magdalene bloodline. Saunier had discovered some form of magical ritual that immediately made him the superstar among the European royalty.
Yeah, so it was like the Hartlepool Blanchefort of Rennes-le-Château had hit poorer times and had been massively wealthy, and they had a family secret that had been passed down and passed down through the generations. And a lady called Mary de Blanchefort, she had the secret. But she could nobody to pass it on to because husband had died, she'd lost contact with the children. So it was hid in the church because it was their family chapel, hid by the previous priest that was there, Jean Bigard. But he had to flee the country because of the revolution into Spain. So they lost it. They lost that secret. And Sonia obviously found it. Because he'd been sent there with a royal sort of a royal job to do, and like I say, it just seems like it seems obvious now that's what he was doing. Because the meetings he would have and the sort of garden parties when there was a big list of different types of meats, and we're talking a poor area. And all sorts of different types of fish, and I think there's about 24 starters, and all the wines and champagnes and all this sort of thing, and so that is like a massive banquet, and he laid
Yeah.
out the gardens in from flower plants from overseas and different types of exotic animals and birds and all that sort of thing. So I mean, this is like a massive party, what would you call it, and
It's
banquet.
a classic pagan bacchanalia.
Yeah,
Yeah, it
and it
sounds
was.
like something from from Rome, the height of its decadence. Again, I'll put that in air quotes, but it very much I've got in my mind's eye, that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but it seems that the reason for that was that he was. It was to please Asmodeus.
Yes, in pagan times, particularly Greco-Roman classical pagan times, we all grew up with the stereotype of the Romans lounging on this chair with the grapes and the wine and the beautiful women walking around in the togas and all this stuff and gorgeous formal gardens within, Italy or Athens or Rome and stuff like that. People don't understand in the post-Christian era that they were also spiritual events, because not only were the guests attending these events, but also they were put on in these lavish circumstances to entice gods such as Asmodeus in the earlier periods during the time of King Solomon. But later, now this, you remember, Judaism actually has its roots in paganism, and also the later times they would have had Dionysus, Pan, Bacchus, this kind of thing. And you would have the food on the table was also for the gods as well. They were invited to the banquet, and by invoking the charge of their power at the banquet table, they would reward you with favors in life. So if you brought them in there and the gods were there and they were pleased that you did them for them, this is basically what sacrifice means. You sacrificed a sizable portion of the actual party or the bacchanalia to the god. You would have power, you would have wealth, you would have security. And this had been lost by the Blanchefords. It had been brought via, now this tradition also existed in Solomonic Judaism. This is before the time, this is way back in Jewish history, where there was a kind of a schism in Jerusalem between the sort of like the pagan kings of Gehenna and the emergence of the monotheistic Yahweh tradition. King Solomon is very much on prior to the building of the first temple, a classic example of a Jewish pagan who then became a kind of an Orthodox Jew. Now, this was a power force that directly related to the social and the political condition of French aristocracy in that period, because of things such as the rise of the republicanism and so on, that they needed, that they had lost this kind of power. And Saunier was almost like a subcontractor who had discovered these documents in the church during the renovation, and this is why he was immediately summoned to Paris to meet with these people, and suddenly became, their boy.
When he was over in Paris, it was well known that he got involved with lots of secret societies, occult societies. So he was definitely involved in that sort of thing. And looking at Solomon as well, when the Visigoths sacked the temple, they brought all the wealth. Oh no, they sacked Rome, wasn't it? So
The sack
I think,
Rome. The
yeah.
Romans brought it from Jerusalem.
They brought it from Jerusalem when they attacked the temple, and then the Visigoths attacked Rome and brought all the wealth and hidden secrets from Rome to Rennes-le-Château.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
LegalizeFreedom.com.